In fact, there's, the main role of the federal government is to probably give money to states and localities, allocate federal funds to local states and cities to address the housing crisis. But the laboratory of innovation is going to be at the local level. So, and that's where, yeah, the great local organizing work, a lot of these community development and housing groups are on the front lines of kind of creating a new housing economy, really.
Well, give out a website where people can find out, Chuck, about the report and even download it directly.
Yeah, people can go to Institute for Policy Studies, ips-dc.org, and look for the report Billionaire Blowback on Housing, co-authored with our friends at the Popular Democracy and Institute for Policy Studies. And you'll see a lot more detail.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomas on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9.
What does the average KBOO listener think of self-help radio?
This is so hard and complicated.
I have no idea what it is.
What is this old-time music?
I feel so proud of myself.
Seems kind of worthless.
Why does it have to make so much noise?
It is very hipster.
That's the worst thing.
Look at how humanity has used their intellect.
Self-help radio, a different theme explored with music and talk every week. Tuesdays, midnight to 3 a.m. on KBOO Portland.
Can't get good reception of KBOO on your radio? Just type in www.kboo.fm on your PC or laptop and click on Listen Live. We're just a mouse click away.
This is Medea Benjamin. I hope you listen to Community Radio KBOO 90.7.
Welcome to Running on Air, produced at KBOO Community Radio here in Portland, Oregon. I'm Barbara Bernstein.
And I'm Jeremiah Hayden.
And we'll be your hosts for this evening's Running on Air. It's a daily radio roundtable conversation with the people running to represent Portland. In this episode, we're talking with Portland Commissioner Rene Gonzalez, who's running for mayor. We want you to join the conversation. You can call the air room with questions for candidates at 503-231-8187. You can message a question on the website, kboo.fm, and you can also email us your questions at runningonair@kboo.org. So let's meet our candidate for the day. Welcome, Rene.
So glad to be here. Thanks for hosting.
So we'll start by just getting a little sense of who you are and where you come from. So what is it that you've done in your life that's made you run for mayor?
Yeah, that's a good question, and something my wife asks often. What were you thinking? But a little bit of background. Fifth generation Portlander, but spent most of my youth up in Anchorage, Alaska, and then came down for college in law school and decided to stay here. At the time, in 2000, Portland felt like the most, European, most livable city that you could imagine in the United States. A great place to walk and cycle and public transit. And maybe not a place you were going to go to get really rich, but a place where you could live a good life. And so we always knew that this was a place where we wanted to work. We would want to raise a family. Was on that path for a long time. And then was civically engaged. I was on boards, Children's Museum Board, was the president of a big youth soccer club, tended to have a real children orientation in terms of my community outreach, but was also working my life in the private sector. I got involved publicly in 2020 in a kind of a different way, and was really kind of born out of as we were starting to get data about the pandemic, particularly out of China early on. Well, first of all, before public schools were going to close, we were going to pull our kids out of public schools. We were concerned about the pandemic and what we were hearing out of Asia. I was connected with a lot of people in technology. We own a small technology company, and we're watching this kind of the wave of the pandemic and watching how folks were responding, and it was terrifying. You know, early 2020 was very, very scary time when you saw what was happening in Asia. All we didn't know, and how you adjust. So, we were going to take our kids out of school before they closed, but throughout 2020, during that spring, as that turns into summer and into fall, we were also starting to get reasonably reliable data out of Asia, still hard to tell, but that we were seeing different segments of the population had different risk profiles with respect to COVID. And that starts to have some interesting public policy implications, right? And so in that fall, I became involved with some family groups that were trying to figure out, is there safe ways to give kids return access to sports and to arts and to school? And we didn't know how long it would take to get the vaccine at that time. In fact, some people thought, we don't know if we're ever going to have a vaccine. At least there were some public health folks that were really questioning whether we'd ever have one. Fortunately, everything exceeded expectations. We got a vax much sooner than a lot of people thought. But it was playing through those implications. My gosh, like, we just have disrupted families' lives, working families in particular, working mothers the most, at really important parts of kids' ages. So that got me involved publicly. And it was really one of these things, and one of the worst things that happened for families at the time is, you know, Trump came out and said schools need to reopen. And that sort of instantly gets a response in Oregon and in the middle of a presidential election, it felt like as families in the region, we were getting caught up in national fights that it didn't feel right as we were trying to navigate it, you know, just what's right for our families, what's right for our kids, and still be responsible.
So what were you actually trying to do?
We were trying to get kids back in school safely. That was in prioritizing reducing the harm that was caused by closed schools. And some of the data at the time, a substantial portion of child abuse cases are found only through public schools. That's how they're discerned. And we know for a lot of marginalized families, when you close public schools, the alternatives aren't great. And I don't think there's necessarily a direct connection to some of the gun violence we've seen in Portland, but I think it was one of the many factors that contributed to some of the increase in violence among youth. It wasn't the only thing. We had a lot going on, but disrupting access for at-risk children, folks on the margins, frankly any child, but disrupting healthy relationships with adults are not positive for long term.
Now, I recall that the teachers union and teachers in general were very upset about this push to get the schools open before there was a vaccine. And I think that your proposals were not very popular with the vast majority of teachers and probably also a lot of other parents.
I think there was mixed opinions about it, for sure. I mean, the union took a strong position. By the way, we encouraged teachers to get vaccinated early. We started out really focused on sports, where it was outdoor, you know, and you could, there was even more questionable early on about really what kind of risks are there playing soccer or something outdoors, doing track. The challenge was, even after vaccination, many still didn't want to return to school on the teacher side. And at some level, I understand it. Our whole lives were changed. We started to get into certain patterns. There was still risk after vaccine. There was different risk than there was before vaccine. But, you know, but anyways, that was part of how I never really criticized the initial decision to close schools. I think that was the right one. Again, I would have taken my kids out either way. It was just, how do we adjust to with never perfect information. I mean, but changing understanding of some components of it. And I took that experience and kind of looked at what we were going through in the city at the time, and I sort of felt similarly on things like crime and encampments, that we were struggling to really break things down into components without it being ideologically driven. So that's long story short, that's how I got started in politics in 2022.
Yeah, you mentioned that, you know, speaking of the, it's ED300, right, is the organization that you're talking about that
brought ED300,
yeah. ED300, yeah. So, I mean, it is, you know, you mentioned like Trump and everything kind of gets like thrown into this, you know, sort of world where people are really criticizing any ideas, maybe simply because it's, you know, based on this one president that people are not really comfortable with.
Than uncomfortable.
Yeah, yeah, right. I'm being diplomatic. Oh, yeah. The organization did end up also making some sort of strange bedfellows, right? It was partnering with some groups like Moms for Liberty, some like very conservative groups that advocate against critical race theory, kind of anti-trans orgs, and then endorsing some anti-LGBTQ and Islamophobic candidates. I'm curious if your perspective has changed since then. How do you kind of think about those, you know, maybe strange bedfellows, or do you kind of stand behind, you know, endorsing some of those candidates?
Well, we actually had to pull back an endorsement of somebody that was anti-LGBTQ. I mean, we saw some of the things she was saying at the time, and we were supporting folks who were rational about reopening schools, and that was what our criteria was at the time, and keeping access to public schools. So we also pulled back or chose not to endorse someone because of comments made about George Floyd at the time. And frankly, we were, I think sometimes the memory's gotten distorted on this about vaccination. We really didn't tolerate a lot of anti-vax rhetoric within our community. And some folks were actually banned from some of our Facebook pages over that, because it just was going in a direction that wasn't central to how do we get kids access to these things safely. I mean, that was the goal. And on vax, it's like, you know, if you were in the Portland group, you were getting vaxxed, all your kids were getting vaxxed. Mm-hmm. Like, there wasn't even a question. We were do what was part of it. But so I guess I would just emphasize that, like, we actually disqualified some folks for things that got too far afield that weren't on that core piece. You know, Moms of Liberty, I don't know that we ever really partnered with them at all. Like, I mean, that was sort of a separate movement that was very tied to the Republican Party. Was there people in our statewide group that were also parts of it? I'm sure there were. I mean, but there was no kind of affiliation there whatsoever. We were an independent group. And in Portland, I mean, one of the fascinating things about that, Portland, you're still talking, vast majority of these families are liberal Democrats. Like, I mean, it's with very different perspectives on national politics than other people in other parts of the state. And so we found common ground on getting kids back to school, but there's broader conversations going on about public schools and what's the future, that was not really what that group was focused on, even though some of the people in the group may want to, you know, take those things on, you know, defunding the Department of Education. We didn't want anything to do with that. That was never part of what we're involved in, radically changing the State Department of Education. You know, that's not part of what we were involved in.
Well, I think we're going to take a little break. You're listening to Running on Air, a production of Cable Community Radio. I'm Barbara Bernstein. I'm here with Jeremiah Hayden with Street Roots. And today we're talking with Portland City Commissioner Renee Gonzalez, who's running for mayor. You can join the conversation by calling in your questions to the air room at 503-231-8187 or by messaging us on the KBOO website, kbo.fm. Let's get back to our discussion. Well, when the Portland City Charter was changed, yeah, and it was changed by initiative with an overwhelming support for it, you and fellow Commissioner Dan Ryan proposed another ballot measure, which would basically rescind most of what was part of the change, particularly ranked choice voting. And I also, you both were really opposed to the mayor having no veto. So I'm wondering why you chose to run in this new form of government when you had so much criticism of it to begin with.
Well, let's take a step back. So I was supportive of charter reform in a general sense, right? The professionalization of management of bureaus, I think there was broad recognition that that was a good idea. Separation of the legislative and executive branches, I think that makes sense to a lot of people. Our existing council was too small for our population. Having only four plus a mayor in a city our size, you know, that's a 100-year legacy in terms of the size of the, so expanding the council, professionalizing management of the bureaus, separating the legislative and executive branch, fully on board with. And actually, I'm not really opposed to ranked choice voting in a general sense. I mean, I think that led to a good outcome up in Alaska in a congressional race. I mean, Sarah Palin got defeated because of it. You know, we'll see how it plays out for me, given some of the movements out there. But I actually think that, you know, I would love if we had ranked choice voting at the state level at the without closed primaries, if we really could have it all in. I think that would be a healthy thing for our state.
Now, you did say at one point that you thought the people of Portland were not smart enough to know how to do ranked choice voting.
I'm not sure that's exactly what I said.
That's a paraphrase of what you said.
I think that the part that we were really focused on is the way council candidates are elected with multi-members in a district, and the single transferable vote, like how well people really could understand it. That was always the tension point. In fact, when we were proposing alternatives or just creating the space for the discussion, it was to recommend that you have the same version of ranked choice voting used in the mayoral races be used in the council races. And I think it remains to be seen whether we were right or wrong. I don't know. I mean, we're gonna see that we're in this grand experiment, and I would have, and taking a step back further, right? So you're seeing at the state level all of this out-of-state money come in to on at the state level to pursue ranked choice voting, millions of dollars. I mean, it's that's not from Oregonians that are funding this experiment in ranked choice voting. It's out of state, and the same thing was true with our ballot, with our own charter reform. There were substantial out-of-state dollars that funded that experiment. They don't live with the ramifications. If the experiment goes wrong, we live with the ramification. And that's, you know, that shapes some of my view on that, but I am not opposed to ranked choice voting. And even when we were proposing, was not proposing abandoning ranked choice voting. It was this one somewhat experimental component.
Well, I think what disturbed some people in the city was that the voters had really spoken pretty fluently about their position, and it seemed rather anti-democratic to say, no, we're not going to listen to you, we're going to put this other initiative, because it sounded like you're saying the voters aren't smart enough, and so we're going to do this thing because we know better than you do. So I'm curious about how that thinking, when you proposed another initiative that would have remanded parts of the one that was passed, how that fits in with your decision to run for mayor.
So take a step back, and there was an important judicial decision made on that ballot measure. That was whether to do it in three pieces or one. And a lot of legal experts thought the judge was going to say, you're going to have to split this charter reform into three pieces because it did so much all at once. And so voters were never given an opportunity to choose which pieces of the proposal they liked or didn't like. It was either all in or all out. So the question of what voters intended at the time, I don't think that's crystal clear. And the whole point about sending something back were refinements, like the question of mayoral veto. The mayor doesn't have a veto in the existing form. That was not a question that voters even got to ask. It wasn't a choice. The concept of whether you have 12 members or 8 members, that wasn't a choice voters were given. So it was an either or package that a lot of people didn't expect would be presented that way to voters. And you know, that was what we were trying to clarify. And I think, you know, we go through this election, I think there's gonna be other opportunities to assess what makes sense, what doesn't. I mean, one of the questions, how long is it gonna take to figure out who sits on city council? Like, that's really an open question. Maybe we're gonna know like by the Thursday, or maybe not. I mean,
they do certify the election on December 12th. I guess I do have a question about or December 2nd, sorry, fact check myself. I do have a question about, like, there was significant work done in advance of that to sort of lay out what it was that voters were voting on. It does become a much smaller thing in a voter's pamphlet, but generally people may have had a pretty good idea. I guess what it maybe speaks to, and to Barbara's question, is like, why do you and Commissioner Ryan step in then later to say, hey, you know, maybe you didn't know what you were getting into when the voters did pass it by a pretty significant margin?
Look, we weren't proposing to repeal what voters had just approved. It was to clarify voters' intent on a couple of very specific items. We weren't proposing repealing charter reform. That's a real mischaracterization of what we were attempting to do. There were three, you know, I think the two big components was council the right size, right? 8 versus 12. And mayoral veto, I think we had a third component we were batting around at the time. And so there were discrete questions, but it wasn't to override the voters. It was to send it back to them and clarify, is this actually what you intend? And again, well, I want to see what voters think after this election with council races. I mean, that's one of the people. But your question was, you know, what do you, if you had concerns about the new form of government, why would you run in it, right?
Particularly, why do you want to be a mayor if you, it's not a very powerful position.
It's a critical time for our city. You know, I think we are defining what a Western city is going to look like post-pandemic. And that's a immense opportunity and immense challenges that our city is facing right now in this moment. And there's another side of that. I half joke, you know, I half ruined my life when I ran the first time, so why not double down? It's like you're on the Oregon Trail. There's no turning back. You know, my wife only laughs about that a little bit, but the other component is, you know, when I ran, I was running for a 4-year term, and then you find out the day you're elected, oh no, that's actually now a 2-year term. And it's, they didn't tell you that when you ran. That wasn't even clear until the version was approved after our primary as to what would go to voters, how they were, that was going to impact the existing council members. So you're sort of, you know, there were a lot of reasons, but what I'm really inspired by is, you know, how do we return Portland into a welcoming, inclusive place that is healthy, that is safe, that is beautiful, and one that families can grow and see, elders can age in place, and people who create can thrive. You know, that's inspiring to me to go pursue it.
Well, there's one point. I mean, you were quoted on some interview, and I don't remember, it might have been OPB, I'm not sure, where you were asked, what would you do if you disagreed with the city administrator, who's really going to be running the city? And you said you'd fire him. And then until another administrator was appointed, you'd run the city. And that's not in the spirit of the charter that's been approved. So I just wondered where that's coming from.
Well, the mayor has the authority to remove the city administrator at any time. And so that doesn't...
With the city council. The city council has to approve the administrator and has to approve firing the administrator. The
mayor can remove the city administrator. They have to give notice to council for removal. So that's a common misconception. Appointment, the mayor appoints, that's subject to sign off from council, but removal, the mayor can do at any time with advance notice to council. And yes, they serve... Those aren't my words. That's the words of the new charter. They serve in the absence of a city administrator. I think there are, so ultimately, city administrator reports kind of dually to the mayor and to city council. It takes a supermajority of council to remove them. But you're appointing someone that aligns with your perspective. And so that shouldn't happen very much. And there are other elements where, you know, the mayor oversees this, appoints the city attorney, the police chief. I mean, there are a number of areas of pretty significant direct charter authority in the new mayor. I think it's a misconception of the new charter creating a position that is weaker in mayor than exists under the existing charter. I think people are going a step too far. They haven't actually read the language of the charter. I think in many ways, it's not a quote-unquote strong mayor form, but I think the clearly delineation of administrative and executive authority is stronger in the new charter than it is in the existing one.
Well, I want to get on to another subject that's of great interest to KBOO listeners, because we sent out a questionnaire about what people were most concerned about with the city election. And one of the topics at the top is climate.
Yeah.
So we have a couple things. And Jeremiah, did you want to ask the first question about climate?
Yeah, this gets back, I guess, to another move by you and Commissioner Dan Ryan in talking about the city potentially restructuring the voter-approved Portland Clean Energy Fund, or potentially even referring that ballot measure back to voters to potentially cap the amount of tax dollars that PSEF can collect. As climate change continues to worsen and impact low-income people, seniors, people of color at disproportionate rates, how do you think the city should address its part in the climate crisis on a local level and how you prioritize those PSEF dollars?
Yeah, I think we have a tremendous opportunity to be a national and global leader on green and clean energies. And we have a pretty darn good track record with that already. When we talk about carbon reduction that is necessary at a global scale, right? We're a drop in the bucket in the city of Portland. Like, in terms of our current footprint, we're kind of a drop in the bucket even in the United States, and but globally, not much impact. So we really want to contribute to the climate challenges, and is what can we create locally that has scale beyond the city of Portland, and you know, even theoretically globally. So there's some really interesting things we're already good at. I mean, our reputation as a green city attracted things like the E-Series. You know, these are race cars, electric powered, I mean, kind of global jet setters who come to Portland because, and the only reason we got that race in the first place is because of our green bona fides. I think it can build a whole, I mean, we're going to lose the race next year, unfortunately, to a bigger market, but that was because we were authentic and real. And I think for me, if we really want to focus on things like carbon reduction, it's figuring out how do we support local industries, think tanks, educational institutions that can scale beyond the city of Portland, beyond the state of Oregon. I think that's where we're going to have our most significant impacts. And PSEF can do quite a bit in that area. It's already doing some good stuff in that area. But part of my focus is what's going to have a multiplying effect beyond just the city of Portland in the space.
Well, PSEF has a totally different focus, actually, than what you're describing, because it really deals with environmental justice issues and it deals with people who would be left out of being able to buy EVs or put a heat pump in their house or things that are really essential. Actually, the heat pump's probably more essential than an EV. And so I'm just wondering about your position now on PSEF, since you seem to be a bit antagonistic to it when it was first initiated.
I would never oppose PSEF.
Well, theoretically, but you wanted to cut funding for it.
Well, so
and you wanted to refer it back to the voters again.
Take a step back. So the corporate surcharge, which finances PSEF, right? That was it's bringing in about seven times what was originally envisioned when that went to the voters, and so. We don't have a sales tax in the city of Portland. You know, obviously we don't have a state sales tax either. That makes our revenue incredibly income tax dependent. And fortunately, the city also has a separate business tax that state is somewhat stabilizing. We'll see. When we don't have, so the corporate surcharge is a tax on gross revenue. It has many of the components that are similar to a sales tax. It isn't quite a sales tax, but it has similar characteristics in terms of stability, even when incomes drop. And so that's a really important source of a potential source of revenue for community needs. And the question that I'd like to send back to voters at some point is, look, we're looking at a brutal budget cycle coming up here next year for the city of Portland. I mean, there's just no two ways about it. With targeted cuts of 5%, I think we're looking at worse cuts just given on current revenue projections and expense growth. So there's a lot of services that Portlands care about. Should we take some of the corporate surcharge and use it to fund some of those things day in and day out that Portlanders expect from the local government, especially when the corporate surcharge squeezes out a little bit our community's capacity for sales tax because it's got some similarities? one other piece here, because of how high our taxes have gone from 2020 to today, is, you know, by some studies, we're number two or number one in terms of total tax burden in the city of Portland, largely because of metro taxes in Multnomah County in the last couple of years. That makes it hard to go raise revenue at the city level. We went and polled doing a bond and levy between parks and fire. It polled very well, but the prospect of adding one more cent of taxes to Portlanders right now, when we're losing folks, made that hard. So that's why corporate surcharge is very, very important, I think, for us to talk about. If we want to keep up service levels on the core services we want in the city of Portland, we haven't even talked about deferred investment in infrastructure. We have a multi-billion dollar deficit in investment going back generations. Like, it's very hard for cities to invest in things like core infrastructure because it's unsexy. It doesn't excite anybody. And so we have this ongoing deficit in that area. I would like us to think about at least some of the corporate surcharge. Keep the promise to voters as to how much was going to go into PSEF, but think about some of those dollars for infrastructure reserves and for some of the core services that people want and care about from a city of Portland.
Well, I think that people would disagree who supported PSEF and who voted for it, that the vision of that was actually, there's a lot of environmental needs. I mean, I don't think that PSEF has, you know, scratched the surface in a lot of ways of what the needs are. So it's, there's a lot of disagreement about, there's a lot of disagreement on the part of people who really worked hard to get PSEF going and who are working to keep it, and it's doing some amazing things, to not take any money away from it, because the vision wasn't that it had this limited amount of money. The vision was, this is what it was dedicated to do.
But it's already shifted dramatically, you know, and one of the things I'm not thrilled with in this last budget cycle for PSEF is that I kind of felt like there was some greenwashing going on, right? I mean, if things could be just, so there's a lot of money now flowing into the city budget from PSEF. If something was described in terms of carbon reduction, it got funded. But if it wasn't, doesn't check that box, even if it's serving some other environmental purpose, it won't get funded. And so to me, that's not really a rational decision-making. I would love some of PSEF revenue, specifically corporate surcharge that funds it, to pay for things like bike lanes and sidewalks and some of the other infrastructure that we need in the city of Portland. But don't just make that about carbon reduction. That has a whole bunch of other reasons to justify those investments: the health of the city, our social effervescence, our connecting as a community. And so I don't think the status quo is quite what people think it is, in terms of, especially when you watch the amount of greenwashing that goes on to get PSEF dollars into the city budget.
I guess we can move on, but still within the kind of climate world, 27 candidates for city council.
Actually, I think we should take a little break before we get there. So
you need to take a break.
Okay, yeah, so thanks, guys. Let people know that you're listening to Running on Air, a production of KBOO Community Radio. I'm Barbara Bernstein here with Jeremiah Hayden from Street Roots. Today we're speaking with Portland City Commissioner Renee Gonzalez, who's running for mayor. Join the conversation by calling in your questions into the air room at 503-231-8187 or by messaging us on the KBOO website, kboo.fm. And so we're going to take a little music break for a couple minutes, and then we'll be back. And you're listening to Running on Air, a production of KBOO Community Radio. I'm Barbara Bernstein here with Jeremiah Hayden from Street Roots. And today we're speaking with the Portland City Commissioner, Rene Gonzalez, who's running for mayor. You can join the conversation by calling in your questions to the air room at 503-231-8187 or by messaging us on the KBOO website, kboo.fm. So let's get back to our discussion. So we're going to move to another aspect of climate issues, which has to do with Zenith Energy, which is pretty controversial. And 27 of the people who are running for city council have signed on to a statement saying that they would, actually, I want to get this more exact here. Can you quote that?
DEQ Director Leah Felton to delay a decision on Zenith Energy's air contaminant permit, which would allow the company to continue its operations at the critical energy infrastructure hub, based on the fact that they believe that the LUX process in 2022 and 2023 was not legally sufficient. So this is kind of a broad coalition of candidates who sent this letter. I'm not sure if you've read it or not, but the question is, do you support the next council re-examining Zenith's land use compatibility statement?
I haven't read the letter, the authority of the next council to revisit a previous land use decision, that's an interesting legal question. If they have the authority, I don't have an objection. I'm not sure if they have the authority.
In the interest of the reducing carbon emissions, which is something that you're talking about with PSEF right before the break, Zenith's operations there, you brought up the term greenwashing, and there may be no better example of greenwashing in Portland than the Zenith process and promise to transition to renewable fuels. So I guess, with that in mind, is it something that would be a priority to you to re-examine what's going on at the infrastructure hub? And do you support this Houston fossil fuel company bringing rail cars through people's neighborhoods?
Well, so bunch of pieces there. The cascadia risk to their community, including with the energy hub there, is real. I mean, that's the problem is we don't know if that's next year or 1,000 years, right? Like, that's just, we don't know. And it's as a community, we have to take steps to hedge that risk. And we already do it by our requirements in terms of how buildings are built. It makes it a lot more expensive to convert office buildings to apartment buildings, unfortunately, but we have invested and put protections up to hedge there. And the energy field is absolutely an area we need to be thinking about resiliency. It also flips the other way. That's where 80% of the fuel in the region goes through. And if there is a cascade event tomorrow, assume it's going to take a couple of weeks for the National Guard to even be relevant here, much less FEMA. We're kind of on our own for a little while. The airport, while Cascadia or seismic upgrades are in the works, currently will not function for a period of time after a Cascadia event. The river is actually our primary way to get things in, assuming the railroads are disrupted too. And so the energy hub is simultaneously this huge risk to the community and may be a key component of how we respond coming out of a Cascadia event. It's a total irony, but like right now, like for us to rebound, we actually need the energy hub. And that's in general, and that's where we get the majority of our, the vast majority of fuel, not just for the city, but for the whole region.
What do you say to environmental advocates who say that it's also doing damage on a day-to-day basis to communities as it brings those trains through neighborhoods and those dangers? Considering that, it is the role of the government to provide some sort of safety for its citizens,
yeah.
Or is it?
I mean, there is. I mean, you're trying to, and again, you've got multiple risks, right? All simultaneously. And I mean, we're going through these discussions on electrification a little bit. As your fire commissioner, I opened the first electric fire truck in the city of Portland, and it's awesome. And big old charger down to Station One. Thinking about the fleet and further electrification, I think there's a lot of reasons to be excited about that. But when you get back to the question of resiliency, if the grid's down, right, you're not going to be able to, we have to figure out how we're going to charge electric fleet. And when you're talking about public safety things that have to be on no matter what, particularly in a crisis, this is a real question mark of like, how deep do we go down on those things? So you're stuck with still part of your fleet's using diesel. And, you know, and we've made a lot of progress with sustainable and renewable diesel. Our vehicles are getting more efficient. When we're talking about carbon reduction, it is there sort of this question, is what's the best way to have the most impact and still be resilient to other risks, like cascade risk? And sometimes what's better for climate change may have a different answer than what's best for hedging on the Cascadia risk. And anyway, so that's sort of, and it's go ahead. Did you?
Yeah, we actually need to move on to homelessness. And you have a question there.
Yeah, are you ready to talk about homelessness?
I talk about it every day, so let's go.
All right.
Actually, before we do this, I forgot. I have some announcement I have to make.
Oh, you have an announcement.
Yeah, I want to let you know that support for Running on Air comes from KBOO members and the League of Women Voters. More information about the candidates on your ballot can be found on the League of Women Voters of Portland's website, lwvpdx.org. The League has videos of candidates' interviews and forums, as well as links to candidates' written answers and questions and explanations of ballot measures. That's lwvpdx.org. Now back to homelessness.
So just a couple weeks ago, you and your colleagues Mingus Maps and Dan Ryan asked the city attorney to draft an ordinance to sever ties with the city and county Joint Office of Homeless Services. How does it benefit the city to work independent of the county on the issue of homelessness?
The city cannot work independent of the county on homelessness, particularly when you look at the multiple segments inside that population. There will forever be an interdependence between the city and county. The question is whether the existing vessel is the most effective way to do that. The city innovated, started before I was on council, with task sites and safe rest villages. These are turning out to be an extremely effective way of combining shelter and services and getting people literally off the street into some sort of supportive housing. We're getting pushed through there that we've never gotten with congregate shelter. We're getting acceptance rate of offers of services that are going up. It's a successful model that was, you know, my colleague Dan Ryan was one of the guys who pushed for it. There were people in the mayor's team who pushed for task sites, and I think they've been vindicated to a certain extent on that model, despite at the time a lot of opposition from the Joint Office on Homelessness, a lot of opposition inside the community for that pathway. Taking a step back and watching what I'm seeing on the street level, I don't think it's the right idea to move that from the city to the county. And under the existing IGA, that would occur July 1, 2025. I think the city is doing a good job at it relatively. And the close relationship between things like enforcement and offers of shelter, cities have to be on both sides of that in a way. And, you know, you covered a lot of Grants Pass and what's going on down there. I don't think it works to separate responsibility for keeping sidewalks clean and offering of immediate shelter. I'm not using the term emergency, I'm just saying immediate shelter, like getting someone off the streets in a better place before they're ready for housing or before housing's available, right? So that's a conceptual issue. Second, we did have some specific milestones on tents and tarps and harm reduction that the city articulated. For us to commit to stay in the agreement, we wanted to have shared agreement on policy. The county does not believe the city nor the steering committee should have sign-off rights on those policies. That, I think rational people can disagree, but that was a that was a key component for me to continue this. I was the decisive vote to stay in it, and now I'm the decisive vote to exit it, yeah. At least this version. That was a key component, that can we be on the same page on these issues? I don't blame the county for saying, city, those are our policies. Like, you don't get a sign off. But for us to continue to fund the joint office, that was a condition. Last piece here, supportive housing bond, SHS dollars came on board after the joint office on homelessness. So we didn't have a separate funding source. Now we have a tremendous funding source for the joint office, or whatever we're going to call it next. It gets back to the task sites and safe rest villages. Why send 35 to 41 million every year to the joint office, and then have a bunch of it just come back to task sites and safe rest villages? The city can support those as is. We're still going to need the county for behavioral health in the back end. We are highly dependent on the county for a whole bunch of the vouchers, how that flows through. I mean, this is a key part of getting people off the streets, into shelter, into some sort of housing, is that voucher component. And we're going to need the county there. But I just think we need to rethink the relationship.
Why now? The discussion around that set the date at October 15th, which is incidentally 3 weeks before the election. Does this give you an opportunity to just talk about tents and tarps as you're campaigning, or why now?
You know, the original date wasn't my idea. I wanted a check-in. It was a way to give space. I think, I don't remember which of my colleagues originally proposed the date. The first date was October 1 with a decision by October 15th. That gave us space to see if we could get on the same, at least from my vantage point, let me be crystal clear, because I think the three folks involved here look at it a little bit differently. I think Commissioner Mapps just thought this was a terrible IGA from day one. He hated the old one. I don't want to paraphrase him, but he really disliked this one. He thinks it's a dead wrong way to approach this type of relationship. Dan came in and a year and a half ago was supportive of it, but after working on what was the predecessor to the steering committee, he didn't feel like the city was treated as a fair partner there, and so he kind of soured on the relationship with frankly firsthand experience. That wasn't, you know, it wasn't where he was at the beginning, but that's where he ended up. And I think he probably also agrees that task sites and safe rest villages are better run by the city. I looked at it as I was kind of ambivalent about the relationship at first. I have different opinions now. I probably feel more strongly the city needs to be on the forefront of that immediate shelter. But these other pieces of well-intentioned policies that have externalities, where the city ends up having to be the one to explain it to neighbors and has to clean up, that was an important one for me to have common ground. So I thought the 90 days would give a space to reach a common ground there. Unfortunately, the steering committee didn't convene for 60 days. That was a decision by the county as to when they would start it. So we were already, the mayor and I were ready to meet. I was on the steering committee, and we waited 60 days before we could even have a conversation. And then it was made clear that they don't really think the city, or that what's called the SOC, the steering committee, should have approval rights of those policies. That was a final straw for me.
I want to get a little bit to the rhetoric around talking about homelessness. And that's one of the things that, you know, I think a lot of people who work with homeless individuals every day see talking about camping bans and jail and, you know, these kinds of things as something that really is not helpful for people who are actually in that place. Some of the rhetoric can be a little bit challenging for people, you know, and sort of comparing some of the ways that you talk about this, even all the way to, you know, we were talking about Trump earlier, like some of this sounds very similar to people. And, you know, even direct quotes, you know, our once beautiful cities and state are overwhelmed by encampments. You know, it sounds much like, you know, Donald Trump's, you know, our once beautiful city from his Agenda 47 site are now overrun with homeless encampments.
What's Agenda 47?
It's his campaign website, right? So, I mean, maybe there's some coincidences there, but the way that this is impacting homeless residents who already have a lot of barriers to gaining housing, I'm curious, you know, and again, sorry for a long question here, but like you've also called on the state to repeal House Bill 3115.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. That requires for listeners, you know, local ordinances to be objectively reasonable and take into account the resources that are available to homeless residents. Regardless of that state law, Multnomah County does not have a sufficient number of shelter beds, right? So what would overturning HB 3115 allow you to do that you can't do now?
To be crystal clear, that the expectation is that there's no camping in the city of Portland. That I think that's very, very important for us to communicate, that the our expectation as a community is that you don't camp on sidewalks and public land, that you accept offers of shelter that are given.
Where will they go?
Well, right, you know, the last time we checked, and you're very familiar with the Grants Pass case and Martin B. Boise and the Supreme Court decision, and I think in there, City of Portland is cited as, you know, 70% of the offers of shelter are turned down, right? So, and Seattle...
Why? Do you know why people don't?
I think there are a variety of reasons, some good, some bad. I mean, you know, you have folks that have experienced trauma, pets, partners, those, I think, depending on where you are in a continuum, I think a lot of people would think those are legitimate reasons to turn down shelter, or right, depending on the scenario, but somewhat, you know, a legitimate. I mean, Jeremy, you're on the streets. I just did a ride along on deflection, and watching the intensity of the substance use disorder on the streets right now. I've done ride-alongs with Portland Street Response and chat, and sort of the same thing. Even when some of these guys are sober, even when they don't have high toxicity, getting a sentence out of them as to what they want or not can be really hard. And in that particular segment, you also talk about the segment that's mentally ill. Like, how do we confirm what is their assent to anything? And so an offer of shelter waiting for them to say yes, you can't get them to say yes to anything. You can't necessarily get them to say no to anything. So that's its own separate subset. And then we do have a component, and this is where you and I might disagree, I mean, the most, is that I think there's a group that likes to camp outside, you know, and that's how big that group is. I don't know. You know, that's always the challenge. Where I push back at sometimes some in the advocate space is they say, well, that's a really small segment. Don't make generalizations that could be applied to the whole group. But we know that group exists. We have high school kids that camp outside, you know, on weekends sometimes. We know there are folks that pop up tents right outside their housing for whatever cultural or, you know, reasons they want to do that. So I think the rhetoric and the clarity, let's going back to your original question about House Bill 3115, is that I think it's important that we're clear about our expectations on the right of way. I will also remind your voters, like, the final version, my biggest problem with the camping ban that we have on the books right now is its lack of clarity. I just think you open that thing, it repeats the same problem of the ordinance we adopted the year before. It's really hard to understand.
Well, I mean, imagine being on the streets and trying to understand.
Exactly.
That too, right?
It's how do you
explain? But is that the type of clarity that you're talking about?
Yeah,
is that a police officer could go to a person sleeping on the street who maybe has a disability, and the issue for you is that they couldn't understand where they're supposed to go. That was brought up, not by the city's attorneys in court, but, you know.
I actually
kind of want to move on.
Yeah, I do. I actually agree with the critique of many of the folks that were against the ordinance. There was, both versions are too hard to understand, but I just want to remind your listeners, at the end of the summer discussion, I was okay getting rid of criminality. I was okay getting rid of jail time. I'm not convinced that anyone knows, for the majority of folks, what's going to lead them to accept offers of shelter, whether it is the risk of jail time or some other, you know, ramifications. I don't know the answer. I don't think anyone really knows, for the majority of folks that should be taking offers of services and shelter, what's to get them over the line. So the thing about criminality, I'm the firmest on saying no camping. I'm not necessarily clear on what's gets folks over the hump. One last piece.
Okay, actually, we need to move on because we're almost out of time. One last thing that I want to talk about is the Portland Street Response.
Yeah.
So I want to talk about your initial reaction to the Portland Street response and where you are with it now, because you were not exactly a great supporter of it when it was under the Fire Bureau and Joanne Hardesty was kind of just getting it into action.
Well, I don't know that I ever said anything about Portland Street response when I was running for city council.
No,
I
mean, not when you're running for city council, as a city council member. So you actually were on after she was, but... I'll backtrack. That was inaccurate. But when you came on and you were in charge of the Fire Bureau, which had been Joanne's purview, one of the things that you did was to try to dismantle the Portland Street response.
That's not my take on what happened. You know, one of the first things I approved were positions that I were told was going to get Portland Street response to 24/7. I mean, that's on the books early in my tenure in 2023. I was told by the fire chief, well, these are the last ingredients to get it over the hump and potentially to get Medicaid dollars. That turned out to be, for no bad intentions, but not quite the case. I approved the positions. It didn't lead to 24/7. When I look at Portland Street Response, I think it's an important intervention that gives an alternative to police interactions on the street. That's all great, right? I think a chat also has provided alternative medical response so that we don't have to send an ambulance and a four-person fire truck to certain types of medical needs on the streets. These are really important innovations in our first responder system. I think I'm fully supportive of that. The question about that we're wrestling with in public safety is that it is a finite pie. So where do you invest the next $5 million or the next $10 million? And that's where I think sometimes the debate's gonna be had, you know, and questions about, do you take it 24/7 or do you make sure during daytime it has more staffing, or do you invest in some of that in more additional police officers or additional firefighters? That's the hard work of governing. You got to sit there and make a choice between different investments, and it's not a growing pie; it's a shrinking pie.
But advocates for Portland Street Response complained that its budget was cut and that its plan on being able to go 24/7 was really stymied by the city.
I there's a lot of part of that discussion that. Is some of it I agree with and some of it I just really disagree with. I mean, one of the tough pieces in the last budget cycle is the mayor was starting to look at a tough cycle coming down the road, and he asked all the bureaus to prepare for a certain amount of cuts, right? That was similar to the instructions he gave today. And so Portland Fire, in response to the mayor's request to prepare budget according to certain guidelines, laid out, like, well, if this is our options, we're going to protect primary fire, and we would just recommend cuts to Portland Street Response in response to the mayor's direction to play for this worst case scenario. That was not a proposal to cut Portland Street Response. That was really misconstrued.
We are out of time.
Oh, okay.
Sorry. So we have to leave it right there.
Oh, I'm sorry. I wish we had more time to chat.
Yeah,
I'll come back.
Do another couple hours. But anyway, great talking with you, Renee.
And you guys too.
Okay. You've been listening to Running on Air, produced at KBOO Radio at Portland, Oregon. And we've been here with Portland City Commissioner Renee Gonzalez, who's running for mayor. You can find all the episodes of Running on Air on the KBOO website. That's kboo.fm/runningonair. Episodes are also available wherever you get your podcasts. Our engineer and producer is Althea Billings, and our editor is Aaron Lochner. Tune in to the next and final episode of Running on Air. It will be on Monday, October 28th at 7 p.m. with candidates from District 1. I've been your host, Barbara Bernstein, along with Jeremiah Hayden from Street Roots. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to KBOO Portland,